Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Lots of 2011 movies I associate with being really forgetful, like forgotten. I think Salmon Fishing in the Yemen.
Was that nominated?
No, it was Ewan McGregor and Kristen Scott Thomas, and they were salmon fishing in the Yemen.
It's a funny title, that's why.
And
of the skit of like the films that got gone. Why does nobody remember Salmon Fishing in the Yemen?
Fun time we had at the pub quiz.
It was so great,
wasn't it? A really warm, toasty feeling. We've got some lovely correspondence that we'll read out later from people getting in touch about it.
It's the Pop Kitchen 100 pub quiz.
Fully aware that most of our listeners won't have been there, because it was, you know, not everyone lives in London and not everyone lives in the country who listens to it. And full apologies to that, but those who were able to go and represent the wider.
I could have danced. You know what it was kind of like? I thought it was kind of like going to our wedding, but we didn't know who got invited. Because we sort of did that thing where we circulated. And what was great is we got to say hi to basically everyone, I think.
Yes.
Which was really cool. And you were all lovely.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like we were going around circulating like the bride and groom.
Yes.
And everyone was like, hi,
thank
so
you
happy
coming.
For you. And we were like, oh, thank you for coming. But like we had never met them.
Yes.
But some of them I recognized when they said their name. I was like, oh, you're that person.
Yes.
Which was nice to see.
Which freaked them out a little bit.
Yeah, it did freak them out a little bit.
I agree. It was very touching, and it was lovely that all of you guys were just so pleasant.
Yeah.
What I enjoyed was we had to put a lot of teams together, people who were in twos and threes, we combined them. And actually in doing so, we did create the winning team.
Yeah.
And every team I saw that we merged was getting on so great, and especially when they won.
Yeah.
I think it was very heartwarming.
It was just a really nice night. Nice, like lots of fun reactions and people finding out the answers.
Absolutely. Head to our socials if you haven't seen the highlights. Yeah. There's photos. We've got a whole video highlight of the whole thing. And it was just a pleasure to get out of the studio.
Totally.
And get out in the real world and meet people. You're right. And shake hands, put faces to names, and people come up to us and say,
my mate was genuinely so happy that he knew exactly how many Marvel films had been between Iron Man and Captain Marvel.
Oh, really?
Like later he was like going to people like, guess how many? Because I know. Guess, go on. including... like the same
story. I got a video of me. Someone got a video of me reading out that question. And if you zoom in, there's a guy like right behind me. He's going... hands in his head, like
he's
thinking,
like, fucking Shang-Chi and the Eternals. What? All the ones you forget.
So we will obviously. It was a great experience, and it was a great. It felt like our birthday
it really
week,
was,
our 100 episode week, and we, you know, we've got plans for the future, and we hope to.
I'd love to do another one, a little bit bigger.
A little bit bigger. But well, it's given us confidence, so it's opened up something new. It's the beginning of something. So thank you very much.
On tour,
Wembley.
Yeah, Madison Square Garden.
I was with James in the tour bus, and he was driving me crazy.
Yeah.
Northern accent to, I guess, Oasis.
Yes.
Kind of 90s rock and roll documentary. He was driving my head. No, that's a bit
and they were just
Gary Marlowe.
The manager, like the jaded manager in like the leather jacket smoking. Yeah. There was no stopping him.
James Briefel. Haven't heard that name in a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was that. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming. And thank you just in general, everyone who gave us nice responses for our birthday week, our 100 episode week. And now, episode 101. We can say that now.
When that finished, I was like, God, that took up a lot of brain space in my head.
What with the quiz?
Even just because we chose it because it was a really great thing to do, but also it was what we thought would be a slightly less workload intensive thing to do to celebrate. But...
huge.
All the time, just a pub quiz, and you know, very tempting to just like ChatGPT the devising of the quiz, but we didn't. We genuinely wrote every single question,
but we also had to rebrand ourselves. This is at a time also when both of our jobs were very, very busy.
It's a busy time, yeah.
So I took 2 days off after the quiz, and I was really appreciative. And I went to a tea room.
I saw Yellow Nice
really
Time.
Good
yeah.
one, a really good one. That was like,
got you going.
My place. And to coincide, what was better is that I went on Instagram on my day off, and who has posted a video on his day off as well, but Richard E. Grant doing, like just capturing the vibe perfectly. I was like, I have to send this to James because Richard E. Grant's there, like having basically just come out of the pool in some sort of spa in
out
Somerset.
Of breath for some reason.
And he's just like, wonderful day off in Somerset. And then he just sort of reclined where he goes, pool, hot tub, oh, yeah, boy.
And it's like, he's filming himself and his phone camera's there.
But he's not really looking at it. No. Sort of, the view out of him is just got to
But I
see.
Was like, Richard, I know how you feel. Yeah. I'm also on a day off and I really could do with the R&R.
He's brilliant, but he's just such an odd presence on social media.
But I like the fact that he's made it his own. Yeah. No one else makes content like Richard
There's
E. Grant.
No, like, niece or nephew to be like, can we just talk about the videos you're putting out on Instagram?
It is just have a wonderful day. Anyway, that was a great week we had. But there are, as we've mentioned for a few weeks now, this is a really exciting time. Oh, there are loads of films coming
loads
out.
Loads of films. If you didn't, because last week for episode 100, we didn't talk about films, but if you did catch our bonus episode, we talked about Anatomy of a Fall and Bottoms, so we didn't leave you without films. So go and check those out if you haven't already.
One of the most, like, two very talked about films, one that really went up there for you in, like, one of the best films you've seen this year.
Up there.
And Bottoms, one of the biggest disappointments I've heard.
Just go and see it. Go and see the
episode. Go see the review. I mean, if you hear my review, I'm not saying go see it. But this week, we have... two big films, James.
Two big films. We've got David Fincher's new film, The Killer, and also, is it Molly or Holly?
I think it's
Molly Manning Walker's How to Have Sex.
But not to be confused with Mia McKenna Hughes, who's the lead actress in it, which
Bruce.
I get confused.
Mia kind of Bruce.
Is it Bruce or
Hughes?
Hughes?
Is that Bruce?
Is it Hughes? Maybe it's a typo.
It is Bruce.
Bear with us.
Let's start that
it's
again.
It's Mia McKenna Bruce.
Basically, there are two big films, David Fincher's The Killer and How to Have Sex, which I don't know how big that's been talked about outside of the UK, but here in the UK, that's a really hot film right now. It's like this year's After Sun. There's lots of chatter about
British
movie release.
Yeah. So we talk about those two.
I am seeing these films, but I haven't seen them in time for this episode, so we'll review them now, but as with all of these films, we will then do a spoiler discussion. Yeah.
Numbered episodes, always spoiler free. In particular with How to Have Sex, I'll be doing a very, very light touch on spoilers because I think people should go and see it. I've already said to George, you should see it, which I know you are. We should wait to discuss it in proper detail when we can talk about the plot and when you guys have seen it too, because I think basically everyone should go and see it.
And you advised... people should not look up what the plot is. Because I don't know the plot. I just know it's meant to be good.
I think I could guess roughly what sort of the themes are about, but I'm so glad I didn't expose myself to even a spoiler-free think piece about what it was trying to do.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say, but I'll get into it in my review later in the episode.
So,
should we do it?
On with those reviews.
I really tried to perfect my Fassbender impression whilst watching the film. Well, not perfect.
Well, you know.
It's hard to really sort of. It's
harsh. It's got more gravel in it.
I picked a line and it's. I find music a useful distraction. I find music a useful distraction.
Useful distraction.
There's sort of a Dutch hardness.
You're going to get the more European.
I'm turning it up to show Dutch. The Dutch. There's sort of a Dutch. A focused tone keeps the inner voice from wandering. And I was like, James, concentrate. You're going to talk about this on your podcast.
Don't just watch a film to get the impression.
So I really feel like with The Killer, David Fincher set out to make a David Fincher film. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're like, all these films are David Fincher films. But if you were to look at, if this film was to join David Fincher's film library on a beautiful bookshelf, it would just perfectly slot in. It wouldn't stand out. It wouldn't, I don't mean that in sort of terms of quality. I mean in terms of themes. It's very familiar Fincher territory, starring Michael Fassbender as the killer, no name. Tilda Swinton's in there and Charles Parnell. Based on a graphic novel, which you really do feel it is very graphic novel-y. And like very much of a David Fincher film, which I'll get onto, you can see within that the likes of Seven, Gone Girl, Zodiac, Fight Club even. And Fassbender, who we know has returned from his little hiatus where I think he had some kids. Yeah. And he's also become a race car driver.
Yes.
See previous TikTok for discussion about that ad episode.
Super happy for Michael Fassbender and also just like really glad to have him back because he's great. And we've seen Fassbender do this very steel-faced, focused, hardened, clinical style of acting before. Like,
in a number of films. Yeah. You go from like Alien Prometheus to even Magneto, Shame, even his character in Inglourious Basterds, like the undercover, very focused, very intentional. And of all of those, I would say this is the most steely Michael Fassbender performance. He is shark-like, like, you know, that vacant shark-like stare, predator-like, kind of like a T-1000 with a consciousness, I thought, like, you know, moving through people, but we have his internal monologue and he's obviously sentient, like a human being. Rarely blinking. Do you remember like a few weeks ago, I told you I watched this featurette about how Fincher was like meticulously planning the blinks and when they would happen.
Michael Fassbender blinked wrong or something.
Again, like a shark. They don't blink. They sort of like have this vacant, dark-eyed stare, and he's always been really good for that. Just very good at playing someone with a very well-held nerve. And so the killer opens during one of his hired assassinations. And as he does with every job, he has planned every single part of it meticulously. He's accounted for every variable. He's considered every angle. He's almost like meditative, but sort of incredibly focused at the same time. And he has this costume that evolves, but it has the same through line. And it's this white bucket hat and these dark aviators, which he sort of tells in the opening scenes, obviously wants to disappear. And it's kind of, I saw one time a German tourist dressed this way, and no one ever wants to talk to or spot or look at or engage with a German tourist. So he's found this disguise that he can use anywhere, and nobody wants to speak to him. And in a cold environment, it's with sort of a white jacket and the glasses, but in a warm one, it's slightly different. And it's always the same idea, but it evolves as and when, where he needs to be in the environment, which I thought was very interesting. And what should be said is that Fassbender barely speaks in this film. 95% of the dialogue on this is his internal monologue. He does speak, but it's maybe a handful of times. And what you hear during basically the entire film is his planning and, most importantly, his process and justification or lack thereof of the work that he does, which is killing. And he justifies his actions, you know, by noting how many people are born and die every day and that me killing someone today is really just a drop in a much larger bucket of death, and how could you sort of look at one thing when really it's like this. And every time he goes to make a kill, he recites these chakra-like statements to himself, where he very kindly says, "This is what it takes. Forbid empathy. Trust no one. Breathe. Calm. This is what it takes. My process is logistical. This is what it takes." Like the perfection.
Like slam poetry by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Sorry, just the way you're doing it. This is logistical. This is my process.
My process is purely logistical.
Sorry.
I'm really trying to get it. And so in this opening assassination of the film, something doesn't go to plan. That's all I'll say. And from that, there are a series of ramifications that the killer now has to resolve. It involves globetrotting around the world, seeking information from one person to the next, trying to find out, killing a lot of people. And it is essentially a one-man show. Michael Fassbender's in basically every shot. And this whole series of events makes him sort of call into question why he does what he does and him insisting that nothing is personal, right? And what I like about it, it's always great to have access to the mind of a very detailed perfectionist in film. You know, hearing someone who's a lot smarter than you do a lot of things you never would have thought of. And of course, like, we're not killers, so we don't ever try to do that. But it's nice to see, or it's interesting to see someone who does do that, to be like, God, yeah, that is how you could do it. That is like how people behave and what they do. And that's really engaging, and it really draws you in. And Michael Fassbender is really good at doing that. And I think what makes the film the most interesting is that I feel like Fincher, who we know of as being very meticulous, very detail oriented. There's like loads of actors who've come out and said that he's brilliant, but he likes to do 80 plus takes in a single moment to get the scene exactly right. And in his films, we've known him to tell stories about obsessive perfectionists who like to get everything right. And you very much get the sense that he is exercising his method and representing that obsessiveness of a character on screen. So there's this nice little sense of the art really feeling like a product of the artist, which I think is always quite interesting to see a character on screen and the creator sort of presenting a way, but then really believing that this is how you get, this something is achieved.
An obsessive film made by an obsessive director.
Yeah. Totally. It's got incredibly even pacing. Nothing is rushed. You've got a score by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. Eric Messerschmidt. Eric Messerschmidt, who is the cinematographer of Gone Girl, shot it. It's edited by Kurt Baxter, who cut The Social Network. Very accomplished, like high-end, this is what it takes, like professionals all executing. And what I thought was quite interesting structurally is that the character of the killer doesn't tell the story at all, but he progresses it very much like a sort of very true protagonist. Mm. So he's not really telling you what's happening, but the plot moves through him. And you start the film with very little information, and it goes on, it becomes a lot clearer, and this, you get to learn about this dark, Fincher-esque world of killers and assassins for hire. And I thought there's almost a John Wick element of it, of there's this underworld of gunmen and this whole like structure happening, living parallel to the real world. You know, like that nice reveal of like all of these structures are in play, but we just really don't know about them. It's definitely very violent, and the killer does some really horribly violent things that a lot of the time you're like, that's a horrible thing to do, and it's quite weird to follow this character in a sense, want them to progress. Yeah. And I think some people might be a little bit at ease, but not a bit uneased by seeing what's happening on screen and being like, am I meant to be rooting for this character or supporting them through it? But I actually think I think the film wants you to feel that, and I think that's why it's actually successful and how matter-of-fact it is. I do wonder if the methodical structure of the pace could have done with a very distinct change and that it could have benefited from something else. A change gear, because I think the ending kind of sneaks up on you, even though I do think the film's really good. But when I think about this film, I think about the fact that it is extremely well executed. And when you start describing art as being well executed, I think it's a good thing. I think you're describing films like this.
Yeah.
It's like clinical.
Yeah.
It's what I describe as like clinical, hard edge, really precise filmmaking.
But does it lose a stickability upon you with if it doesn't have just a hint, a peppering of like emotion in there? Because I'm getting the sense from everyone who's seen it is like they say the same thing, well presented, well executed. But I don't get the impression that anyone's gone, oh yeah, the killer. I love the killer. Everyone goes, yes, the killer.
Yeah. Mm. I liked it. I think part of what makes it interesting is the art of the artist side of it.
Okay.
And that when it comes to a conclusion, you're like, you've seen someone very professional execute something to the highest standard on screen, and you almost feel like I am a target for this filmmaker and his very professional like editors, and who's also been brought down this story in a very methodical way. I do think it's interesting. I think, like I said, pacing wise, it's so precise. It's like I can imagine David Fincher's one of those guys that like irons his bed sheet on the bed, and like he has his eyes right up to the thing, and he's sort of like doing that. You really get the sense that that's who this is of.
Wow. Okay,
and it's interesting. It's cool. I do like it, but it's so different to so many other films that are great this year.
When you said that it's very clearly a David Fincher film,
yeah,
is that ever so slightly a problem? Is it so David Fincher that you're like, it's almost not a parody, but like I'm not surprised by anything. I can see your style and everything. I can just feel you here. I wish you would just have given me something new about yourself.
Not for me, no. I think it's David Fincher.
Is he playing it safe?
Maybe for him, but he's leaning into it so much. He's almost just like, this is how I like to do it, and this is why it's good, and this is why it's right. That's why this execution's good. I do actually think the film's really good.
Okay.
I don't overall have negative feelings for it. I'm more just like overwhelmed by how clinical it was.
Mm.
And the execution of the film, the presentation of it is clinical, and so is the story. So it's just an all fires blazing. Like, here's how I like to do it, and here's what it is.
So I think it's a
successful film. I really do.
Okay, well, I'm seeing it this week, and we'll talk about it next week in spoiler terms. But if you've seen The Killer, which people have, it's been out for a while now. It's out on the 10th of November on Netflix. But if you have seen The Killer, please write it in and let us know your thoughts, and we will discuss them in that spoiler episode.
When I say like you can see lots of David Fincher in this David Fincher film, it's like there's a, like the narrating is very similar, not so much in tone, but to the narrator from Fight Club narrating. Right. Is that slightly world cynical, look at all these people, not quite to the level of Fight
Club. Does Ben Affleck narrate in Gone Girl? I think he does, doesn't he? Like,
yes, he does. And then you can see like the dark obsessiveness of something like Seven, like the style of Gone Girl, Zodiac. Even Elements of Zodiac. Like, it's all just very much there. Yeah. And I don't think that's a criticism to say it falls so neatly in with the rest of his work.
I like
and if
the
you
idea, like
David Fincher, I think there's so much to enjoy there.
Also that idea you just said of, instead of trying to like deliver something new, it's like, no, I'm going to really lean into it and like max out my style on something. Mm. I've got the David Fincher credit card. I'm going to spend it all.
It's maxed it out. Yeah. You know, sometimes we say like directors do a film for them and a film for me. Like a film for the film for us. And it's like, I really feel like David Fincher was like, I'm really making the kind of film I want to make.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Considering you just made Mank, which was also very much a film for him.
Yeah. But it's what you like about David Fincher, I think. I really enjoyed it.
Also, that's...
It's just that... That pacing thing, I think you're a bit like... It's so... Because it's so methodical, you're like, oh, okay. And that's where... And now it's over.
I am interested to see it as well because of following Mank, which was fine, an okay film, but it was Mank was such a swing in a different direction and literally him trying something new.
Right.
That he's followed that with something that's like literally gone in the other direction. But like I said, I'm seeing it this week. We'll talk about it. Let us know your thoughts as ever. That was
The Killer. So the two films I'm talking about this week are completely different. Mm. But after I saw How to Have Sex, which is the second film I saw after The Killer, I was like, oh God, they're so different, but I enjoyed them both. And it's really interesting to talk, to have the chance to think about them and talk about them. And I really annoyed that I can't remember who said this, but it was a couple of weeks ago, I saw a clip on TikTok and a famous writer had said that narratively, as a narrative tool, a fight scene and a sex scene are used in a lot of the same ways. You've got two characters with the raising of tension or conflict or romance that come together in a moment in time, have an altercation that affects both of them in different ways, and both of them leave change from that altercation and there are ramifications as to what happened.
Yeah.
And I thought it was quite interesting. It's like fights and sex scenes or romance, they're used in the same way to tell stories. And so I had heard great things about How to Have Sex from the festival circuit, but I didn't have a chance to see it. I think you had the same experience where you were like an either or.
I chose to see Maestro because it was the bigger film, and look how that turned out.
George's Maestro review is available to listen to. So this is the directorial debut by Molly Manning Walker, who shot Scrapper, which I saw earlier in this year, which I actually really liked. And I could see like a lot of stylistic parallels to this film. So this film is all about a group of girls who are 16. George, don't take this the wrong way. Did you ever go on a... I can't imagine you're the kind of guy who went on a holiday to Magaluf.
Yeah. No, I didn't. No, there were guys in my year. I was, in fact, most of my... I'm friends with a lot of my guy friends from school, and all of them, bar one or two, who included me, went. Yeah, to Zante, actually.
Zante, nice.
Yeah. No, I didn't do any of that stuff.
I did Iron Appa in 2012.
You know, in many ways, it's my idea of hell. And at the time, I was just like, it's just really, as you said,
it's
not me.
I can't pitch you that. I don't mean that as an insult. It's more just like, you know, different things, different people.
I mean, I've been to the full moon party in Thailand. Like, I'm not averse to a bit of neon paint.
No, I'm not saying you are. It's more that... I think I knew the answer to that question, but I was going to ask you anyway. Yeah, Iron Appa 2012.
James, I went to a tea room last week. So come on.
You wore a turtleneck last week. Yeah. So this film is all about three young girls who are 16 years old who decide to do what a lot of young people do at that age and go to one of those European party islands, and they go to Malia. I think, it was Malia.
Malia
that's in Crete. I said it weirdly. Malia in Crete. And the three of them are best friends. They've just finished their GCSEs and they've kind of got that, like, we're going to get our
GCSEs.
Results. Yeah. Oh my God, they're young. Oh, so the lead, who's brilliant in this, Mia McKenna-Bruce, who I swear to God when I was watching it was like, they must be 18, 19, like just adult. She's 26 now. Must have been 25 when she shot it. That, I'll get onto it. She's so good at playing a 16-year-old. But anyway, she's small and young, but she's got those like baby chubby cheeks that are just like baby face. Mm.
Like, well, I bet she'll love you saying that.
Yes. Young face.
Youth.
I was very depressed to hear her in like 2-3 years younger than me. But anyway, they're all going to celebrate the end of their GCSEs, but also kind of get their results. Very high energy. Girls are very much like, leaving the nest, going on a holiday with just each other, experimenting with expressing themselves in a more grown-up way, away from parents, drinking, trying on these costumes, literally of like older-looking clothes, but very much trying on adulthood and what it means to be self-sufficient. Who am I in this new grown-up world? What are my opinions on sex? How do I approach these social situations? And already within this idea of going on the holidays, this very, like those holidays are overtly sexualized. And if you've ever sort of been to those types of bars, it's very much like sex acts on stage, and it's who's going to do this. You know, everyone's there to go and link up and get with each other and have sex.
Isn't it? It's all a bit...
said by someone.
That's what it looked like to me.
Totally. And there's sort of this, so Tara, who's the main character, is still a virgin at 16, but her friend Sky, who's like not older, but is gives off a much more mature energy for someone her age who has had sex many times. And there's already this idea of like, oh, we're in the supermarket. This massive bottle of apple sours is for whoever has the most sex on the trip. They move into their hotel room and there's a twin bedroom and then there's one room with a double bed. Oh, like who's going to stay in the double bedroom? Because whoever's having the most sex should probably have that. So already there's this impetus in an already what you would consider like normal non-sexualized friendship between friends. Now there's this pressure of like, are we going to have sex? Who's going to have sex? How many times are we going to have sex? Am I going to lose my virginity? How? And it's also like how to have sex is like something they would have Googled before they went on the holiday. It's like, how do we even do it? And so what happens is they're in their villa on their balcony, and whilst they're like, you know, waking up for their first night, on the villa over from them is a group of northern boys who they just end up speaking to. And of course they go for pre-drinks and they drink and they end up spending like many days of the holiday together. And the film goes on to be a very, very interesting coming-of-age tale all about this very vibrant, skittish, often comedic story about the power and influence of peers and friends and how important that is and how many things that are said can be misunderstood and how many things can really like weigh on someone and how important the opinion is of someone you know. And I just think it was really, really powerful. I think in the first half, I was sort of like enjoying it. And it's very sort of, I was very aware that these people being represented on the screen are definitely not me. But it was towards, let's say, the last 20, 25 minutes where the film had a really powerful effect on me. And I really understood what it had achieved. And you know, from the hour after leaving the screen, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it really stuck in my head. And I was like, oh, that's actually really, really powerful. It's very effective. It's very sad. And it just, I think Walker has just a really great handling of a complicated tonal range. And I don't want to talk about what happens because I think people should find it out for themselves. But I think sometimes when you think about a story that's very personal or something that's telling something about things that have really happened to many people, it can be quite hard to articulate it in words and to describe a feeling over prose or narrative. But what I think this shows is that you can use cinema in a really effective way to show someone exactly how you feel without the use of dialogue and to actually really effectively put someone who's not the people represented on screen in their shoes to the point where it's really, really powerful. And it's like, I have nothing in common with these people in my part of my life compared to theirs, but oh my God, do I feel sadness and sympathy and empathy for what has happened. And it just brilliant. And like, to me, I was like, yeah, that's why cinematic storytelling is so powerful. And if you might not be able to, I'm not saying the film isn't articulate. I mean that one might not be able to articulate something that's happened to them, but this film is so good at telling you why it's important. And that's why I think it was just really, really powerful.
So James has been light on,
very light,
really getting into there because he's aware of the fact that I'm seeing it. And as you say, you want people to go in and just kind of see it for themselves. So I believe that once I've seen it too, we will really get into it.
This really deserves a discussion of like the moments and the interactions and like especially the last 25 minutes and less of what we think of it, but like how it made us feel and why I think it's an effective story that's told. And then just other things, you know, like what it does really well is that like nightclubs and specifically that like Euro Island party holiday of like bright pink and the blue Gatorade colored sand bucket. It's all bright and colorful. And it's amazing and stimulating. And you're having the best time with your friends. But all of a sudden nightclubs can go from being brilliant to like, oh my God, terrifying. Everything is awful, terrifying, overly stimulating, loud, can't breathe, can't think. And it's so good at like portraying the two sides of that. And like what can be a really sweet romantic interaction can just become sour so quickly, especially for young people who are seeing like this again, like a really unnaturally overly sexualized environment that like in the UK you don't really encounter people like performing sex acts on stage. It's like quite an interesting one.
I think that I'm interested to I mentioned earlier about whether or not it's got like a buzz outside of the UK.
Yeah.
But I'm interested in that because I look at the premise, I look at the poster, I look at the, you know, the description we've described. I'm like, yeah, it's so British. Like,
really,
it doesn't happen in the land of the UK. But
no, it's this a British
this
film.
British culture of like 100%. Going flying out to a European island and yeah. you know and just get party island and just getting yeah. trashed. But also like I'm trying to think when I've last seen that on film, and I think it's like the In-Betweeners movie. Which, like, the whole,
gonna bring
the
it
whole
up, yeah.
thing, the In-Betweeners movie, is
Boys
that.
Yeah. It's Boys Coming Out.
And they send it up.
Which
so
is the
well.
Only film I can remember that's actually depicted that style of, like, European holiday recently.
Yeah, that kind of lads yeah. on tour kind of.
A very, like, sort of pocket of English culture that's quite underexplored.
And they and they do it, and they send it up very well in The In-Betweeners.
Oh, yeah.
They made you realise the awkwardness, the silliness.
And there is an element of that, like, you know, like how dirty their flat yeah. is and sleeping on the floor and ending yeah. up in the pool. But, like, a friend of mine the other day was like, oh, what's good? What's good out? And I was like, oh, just go see How to Have Sex. It's really good. And he's like, what's it about? And I was like, oh, it's about these young girls who go on their first trip to Malia and, like, this sort of, you know, one of them's a virgin. He was like, oh, it's like a comedy. And I was like, oh, no. No.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it has comedic elements, yeah. to be fair to it, but it's not like cool. an In-Betweeners
style. Yeah,
it's not that at all. But yeah, just really interesting. And again, as always, I really want to hear what people's reaction has been to it, because I think it deserves discussion. So for when we do a spoiler conversation, which will likely be next week, send in your thoughts if you've had the chance to see it to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
Sorry, also, I know this is a film podcast,
yes.
but... The Beatles have a new song out.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Is it really
good? Have you
heard it? No, I haven't, but
it's really, really good.
I heard
good.
About it.
It's really excellent. I mean, it's melancholy and sad.
Oh,
and
wow.
when Paul comes out and he says, you know, this is the last, it's the final Beatles record, you know. And you hear it and you're like, yeah, man, this is it. And also, just to clarify some things, because people heard, oh, AI, and they thought, well, they can do anything now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, just to clarify, it's not like Paul McCartney said, hey, Siri, you know, give me a John song, will
write
you?
Me a Beatles tune.
It was like... The
Siri was like, well, what I've got for you is...
yeah, exactly. What they had... Here's the story. I'm going to tell you, actually, because you don't know. John Lennon took a break from music, and he was raising his kids in New York and living with Yoko.
Right.
But he was still creating demos on cassette tapes, recording
sure.
things. Right. Anyway, John Lennon gets shot in 1980, very sad. And then in like the early 90s, George Harrison is talking to Yoko about like they're remastering some old Beatles tapes, whatever. And Yoko's like, I think I have something for you. And she has a cassette from John Lennon that says For Paul. Right?
Whoa.
And on it were three tracks that John Lennon had recorded, right? And that pretty explicitly with the intent purpose of giving it to Paul, right? And they got two of them and they were able to polish it off and play a song with it. And they released the three of them. This is in the mid-90s now, 1995.
Wow.
They were able to play on it, record their three parts and release two new Beatles songs in 1995. But there's one last track called Now and Then was so they couldn't separate him playing the piano over his voice, and it was just really shoddy.
Mm.
And they tried and they thought, this is not going to work. George Harrison famously said something like it's rubbish. It's like pants. And they just abandoned it. Then, you know, time moves on, George Harrison sadly dies, and now it's like 2022. And after Peter Jackson did Get Back, in the process of making that movie, because he is so innovative and his team, they invented a technology which used a little bit of AI writing.
To isolate vocals from...
To separate things into their own channels. So basically demix audio.
Wow.
And in so doing, they were able to separate the vocal from the piano and also use AI to basically kind of like fill
match
in the scratches.
Yeah,
match to fill in the gaps.
Yeah.
So there, plain as day, you then got a crystal clear John Lennon audio. And that's when Paul was like, well, hang on, you know, we could really do something with this. And there's a 12-minute... featurette on it on Disney Plus.
Great. That
and it's
good.
Really, really interesting.
Oh, I should check that out.
Yeah, just for 12 minutes and it tells you about how the song was made. And then Paul plays a bit on it and then Ringo... So Paul's got new plays new stuff on it and he sings on it. Ringo sings on it and he plays drums on it. And they've been able to take the rehearsal attempts that George Harrison did in 1995 and put that on the record. So in a way, you kind of genuinely have...
Spliced through time.
Spliced through time, all four Beatles playing together for one last time. And you hear the song, and it's actually, it's a real grower as well. At first, I was like, oh, that's a good, you know, it's got a good hook. It's got a good tune. And then the more I think about it, I was like, yeah, it really hits the spot. It's kind of, it's sad, charting? It's melancholy.
It's on the radio? Is it charting?
It's on Six Music, which is what I listen to. Yeah. I don't know if it's chart. I don't know if Greg James is going to be playing that. Shut up to...
After Megan Thee Stallion.
Yeah. And now, hot new band, fresh out of Liverpool, four lads.
The Beatles. That's me checking my notes.
But check it out. And as obviously, as a Beatles fan, see...
Look, I'm sure Greg James likes the Beatles.
I know,
modern culture. Yeah.
But as a Beatles fan, it was like, I can't believe it. I got a new Beatles track in my lifetime, the final one. And it feels like a homecoming.
I hope when these artists say, yeah, it's the last one, that it really is, because the number of times, like, this is it. Farewell tour, Elton John. He's done like four of those.
I mean...
I apparently caught his last performance, but I highly doubt.
I don't know. Yeah, I think hopefully Elton. I mean, the thing is, I mean, like, they're two down, the Beatles, aren't they? Yeah. They're two down. I think that it's cool to get a day. They're not going to play live. I mean, the Beatles as an entity doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Anyway. For now, like, they'll be doing the holographic shit. Oh, they'll really get that. So. Oh yeah, they'll do it. Like, there'll be a market in 60 years' time
to do like an ABBA voyage.
Yeah, for the Beatles.
Oh, but that's okay. I think I'm okay. I think I'm okay with that.
You can literally within your headset go like, Alexa, put me in this concert, and then
I do genuinely think that with the ABBA voyage thing, that it is a band as big as the Beatles and as iconic as the Beatles. Is like the next one along
to
do that. Because like, have you been to ABBA Voyager?
No, but I've heard 10 out of 10 things.
Oh yeah, it's just great fun. It's a huge ABBA gig.
Yeah, I've seen clips of people all in their seats dancing, going mad and like...
First of all, don't get a seat. Stand in the actual dance pit so you can actually dance to it. But yeah, especially when Dancing Queen kicks off. Oh my God, it's like...
Yeah.
Forget any time that you've heard Dancing Queen and imagine it the most like... It's like the most emotional like heightened time and you're like... Honestly, sometimes when you hear Dancing Queen in the right moment, you're like, fuck me, is this the best song ever written?
It is. It's that instant, that is like an immediate, that is an immediate mood changer.
It's huge.
It's magic.
And ask any wedding ever.
yeah. What to end with.
But I do hear it and I'm like, wow, that fucking song, Dancing Queen, great.
Best, one of the best gigs you've ever been to, weirdly, and it's like an empty stage.
Well, for ABBA Voyage.
I'm putting words in your mouth, but like...
I didn't say it was one of the best gigs I've ever been to.
One could say. One of the best live experiences you've had. Really, like, live.
Anyway, that was some music chat.
Yeah.
Let's get on with some emails, shall we?
Let's do it. As always, guys, if you wanted to send an email into the show, you can do by emailing into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com. We've received several this week and I'm stalling so George can get them up and decide which one we're going to start with. George, over to you for the first one from... Whoever would be the first one
will be. I can tell you confidently. Stalling for time here on the news. I can tell you.
Really, it's quite extraordinary.
With confidence that the first email is from Ollie.
Ollie
about Letterboxd, and he says, "Hi, George and James. James and George. As a stoic IMDb app user of 18 months or so now, I increasingly feel like I'm missing out by not having Letterboxd. As your good selves, and many listeners frequently mention it. I want to know." Am I actually missing out on something? And what are the advantages Letterboxd has over IMDb? Well,
George, please.
On that question first. Well, I've got the IMDb app, but which is great for pure data.
Yeah.
For seeing casts, for seeing crew and all that stuff. Although Letterboxd is really getting basically as good at that
and
now.
IMDb is quite good to nose over things that people are in pre-production for. Like, yes. Oh, what's that?
It's absolutely good.
I remember like 3 years ago, be like, Killers of the Flower Moon. Oh, Scorsese.
If you want an objective, accurate representation of the data of the industry, that's pretty good. Yeah. But Letterboxd, the reason that raises is high is because I think the functionality, the whole social side of it, the fact that it's the slight social media slant.
You contribute to it. You add your own data.
You contribute,
right?
You follow other people. They follow you. You post your reviews. You post your lists. I just think it's got a slightly nicer UX as well. Whereas like, when I go onto IMDb, it feels like going on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
I'm there for information.
It's quite functional versus user-friendly.
Whereas I like, there's something more curatorial about Letterboxd. And
community, sense of community more.
Also, just shout out to anyone who's followed me on Letterboxd because of this show, which I know we encourage people to do, but like I get a notification every time I get a new follower. And
guys,
I'm like,
follow George on Letterboxd, at George Pop.
I don't post that often because I like to save my review for the show. I embargo myself. Yeah. I don't like to go and give my.
That's good because maybe you know I'd fucking have a word if you were getting all the content out early.
Yeah,
sidelining me, I'd be absolutely furious.
So my solo
career. I'm glad we have a good understanding there.
But so Ollie, that's why we just say it's got like a bit more functionality. It's also just so visual with the every film is listed, just represented by its poster. Anyway,
yeah.
On a related note, how many films do you currently have on your Letterboxd IMDb watch list? I feel like you guys must be approaching the film, completed it, mate, territory of watching films that you're generally interested in. Love the show and best wishes. P.S. Looking forward to hearing your end of year rankings. We will do that.
Yes, we will. Pop Kitchen Awards are coming in hot this year, guys.
Of the films I've seen, I've broadly agreed with your assessments of this year's releases, with the exception of They Clone Tyrone, which I was a lot more positive about. I've heard a few people be really positive about that, more than you.
I didn't really get it.
It had my girlfriend and I really laughing, and for me, it found a sweet spot between silly and thought-provoking, potentially a bit of a Jordan Peele light film, but I don't see that as a bad thing. Ollie, on your question about how many films there are on our watch list, well, I'm going to go onto my Letterboxd watch list right now. And I don't know if it actually gives you a number. Oh, it's a lot.
My watch list is like I make a new note almost every time. And
but
then,
do you see why I like Letterboxd? Because it's so
visual.
Yeah,
it's visual.
Look at all those posters.
Yeah, and it's really nice to engage with it. And go like, oh, what do I want to focus on? Yeah.
Anyway, at George Pulp is the handle.
I like that you've got the whole kitchen imagery on there now.
Consistent. Anyway, Ollie, thank you very much for your email.
This next one is from Erin, who writes in and says, double bill suggestion and some appreciation. Hi, James and George. I've been meaning to email in for a while and have finally gotten around to it after hearing you mention the new Chicken Run recently. My suggestion to people for a double bill is always The Great Escape, 63, followed by Chicken Run.
Of course.
If you've seen them both, then you obviously know why this is a fun combo. Chicken Run basically being a spoof of The Great Escape. There's no need to read this on the podcast as it will be too long. Well, here we are. But I thought I'm finally emailing in for the first time. I may as well let you know how I found you, brackets. It wasn't TikTok.
Oh.
Before starting uni this September, I spent my gap year working and then traveling through Southeast Asia and Australia. In Southeast Asia, I was traveling with my best friend, brackets, who became my boyfriend mid-trip. Oops.
Oh.
Love that. Oops. Oh, God. Accident.
Love.
But he went home after a few months. I continued through Malaysia, Singapore, and Australia alone for another 2 months without my boyfriend there to chat with. When I spent all day traveling to a new place or sitting on a 15-hour bus journey, things got a bit boring. So I decided to look up film podcasts on Spotify. Brackets, I've always loved film. I'm studying film production in uni now.
Oh, wow.
Lots of podcasts came up, so I downloaded one podcast each from quite a few of the different channels. Some were good, some were average. But then I got to yours. I stopped testing out the other ones and just went through all of your back catalogue. Between when my boyfriend went home in May and when I arrived home at the start of July, I listened through all of your episodes.
Wow.
You kept me great company on my travels. Sometimes I would be on buses and trains all day and listen to the show the whole time, only taking breaks to charge my AirPods.
That is amazing.
That is brilliant. And you know what's great about AirPods? That they charge in like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So like I've been on planes where, this is a weird endorsement of AirPods. I've been on planes where I'm like really watching something and I hear the battery low. You can go to the toilet, pee, and you've got like another 30%. It's great.
But also what I like about this story is that you know, this is Erin.
It is Erin.
We'll be watching, you know, the scenic views of Thailand, let's say, passing by, and she will now associate that period of her life with our voices.
I found barbarian.
Yeah.
Bamboozling, baffling, and bloody brilliant.
I did that one time.
Anyway, no, it was the Northman, wasn't it?
It was the Northman, yeah. Anyway.
Blah, blah, blah. It just became such a comfort listen for me straight away. Sometimes when I listen to episodes now, it makes me think of memories from my trip and feels like you accompanied me in a way to all those places. I've had that before where I think back to random podcast episodes and I remember going to like specifically visit Talia in Cambridge, like coming back from the train really late at night, going back to my old uni. I just remember like, yes, I would listen to that. And I remember conversations from places in Cambridge, which is really strange. For example, I was listening to the show whilst on a boat out to the Great Barrier Reef or seeing monkeys on the steps to the Batu Caves in Kuala Lumpur, brackets photo attached. That's an amazing photo. Or when I slept, there it is. She's with a monkey on B-Rail. It's brilliant. Or when I slept on the floor with this random woman's apartment in Singapore because all the hotels were too expensive. Fittingly, I became to date with the podcast episodes as well as I was on the plane home from the trip. When I listened to it, I hadn't realized that it was your newest episode as I'd just been working my way up the list, not looking at the dates, so it really creeped up on me. When I realized that I'd finished the last Your Back catalogue the same day I got home, I thought it was very apt and a lovely end to my trip. Although I did go through some withdrawals, getting used to having to wait a week for each new episode rather than just having an endless supply on tap, so I'd grown used to. I know this is long, my apologies, but I just want to let you know how much I appreciate your content. You don't take things as seriously as other film podcasts, and you just feel more accessible to your audience. Your passion for films is contagious. It made me so excited to start my uni course this September. Hope you're both having a great day, Erin, and then a monkey picture.
Erin, that is genuinely one of the best emails I think I've ever received. It's
really, really cool.
That's really touched me. That's so nice. And I mean, I love everyone's emails, don't get me wrong, but like that is so heartfelt and sweet and lovely. It makes us want to keep doing it.
Oh yeah, 100%. Like I never want to disappoint people by just like running away and quitting.
Yeah.
Having a breakdown and leaving. No, it's like you must be the reason that on our analytics it's like UK 60%, US 30, and then like Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and then there's like less than 0.01% for like a good 70 countries. That must be you traveling, listening to it. No, it's really cool to see.
I also, because I remember Greg James talking about this once again, a second shout out for Greg James today, random.
Shout out Greg James.
About the intimacy of audio, like we have accompanied
in
you.
Your ears.
You know, Erin talking there about all those places she's listened to us. We've been there. Like it's like we're sat next to her.
Yeah.
I would just say my own experience in similarly. So actually, 10 years ago, I was in Erin's position, and I went traveling around. Yeah. Well, actually, I went to South America, Southeast Asia, nice. New Zealand, Australia. Anyway, by the time I got to. I went from South America through New Zealand up, and by the time I got to Southeast Asia, by the time I was in Thailand, and it was probably 3 months in, maybe 4 months in, this is 2013, and I did not have an iPhone yet. I was only not even 19 yet. But like no, but like people, it wasn't like everyone had an iPhone yet. Like,
yeah.
Especially not at my age, like. You could get it, but like, so I didn't have one. I just had a regular phone and had an iPod, okay? Which I was very happy with. But by the time I get to, and sure enough, like I've lasted on my trip by, actually the benefit of not having a smartphone was meant that I had disconnection from social media.
Totally,
I would just go to an internet cafe every like 5 days, just check up on things, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I get to Thailand, like 3-4 months in, getting a little bit homesick. I'm out of, I've exhausted all the music. I've exhausted all the preloaded podcasts I have.
Mm.
And I'm at this hostel, and I'm talking to this German girl, and I'm like, there's a group of us talking about like home and stuff. And I was like, you know what? I've got this 18-hour bus ride across the Cambodian border tomorrow. Like, I really, really miss listening to this film show from the UK. It's called Kermode and Mayo, and it's, you know, on 5Live. And I listen to it every Friday, and I just haven't got it. And she was like, she had a laptop in front of her. She was like, why don't you just give me your iPod? And she just spun her laptop around. She was like, just take half an hour and get all of the episodes. And I did. And it honestly, like, I'm not going to say it saved my trip because I had so much fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But for any long period of travel I had for the remainder of my trip, I had because I'd accrued so many by not listening.
Yeah.
I remember listening to like the Place Beyond the Pines review and like things like that. And
you'll be able to date those reviews weirdly like no other reviews can.
Exactly. Like, I remember specific conversations that they were talking about in specific locations. And she also gave me the soundtrack of The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Okay.
And I remember I was like, this is great.
Yeah.
But when I heard your email, Erin, I kind of connected with that. But that's just so lovely. Thank you very much.
Not to rave about podcasts too much, but you take them on the go. And that's what the appeal of them. You're consuming content whilst you're out traveling, whilst you're out working, studying, painting, whatever you do.
You take them.
And like, no one can underestimate the power of the internet in that way of like, you put a thing out online. And maybe people see it, maybe they don't, but like someone somewhere potentially is experiencing it in another part of the world. You have no idea how they're receiving it and what circumstances. Yeah. And then like, we do a little event with like less than 100 people and it's like, oh, these are real people I don't know.
Mm.
It's very cool. It's very, very cool. Erin, thank you so much for your email.
This next email is from Danny, who says, good day to you, fine gentlemen. I'm Danny from the lovely city of Leeds.
Mm.
Recently in the podcast, you have mentioned films being watched within the calendar year. I set myself... Oh, yeah, we...
Number of films we
Number
watched.
Of films, what? Thank you. Number of films watched within the calendar year. I set myself a challenge to watch a new film or film-length documentary every day.
Oh, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
That is a lot.
365.
If you miss one, are you then going to watch two?
To define new, I mean no rewatches, and it can be something I've never seen before, so it's new to me. Yeah, I have the same criteria.
Yeah.
As of writing this email, I am on 363 films/documentaries of this year. So that means
you've done
more.
One a day.
The latest film I watched was...
Where are we? November. Yeah, you've got 2 more months.
The last film I watched was 1408. Oh, yeah.
With John Cusack the day, yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson. Scary. Which I thought was a brilliant film.
It is scary, I think. I've not seen it since 1408, but like... Yeah.
So I like to think that I may be a contender for most films watched this year.
100%.
Loving the podcast, guys, sirens on my own. That you are, that
There's
is up
you
there.
And someone who has to watch films as like an occupational, functional thing.
Yeah.
That's the only people I can imagine.
Only people who work for the BBFC and they have to give the films the certification, see more films than you.
I am doing this show and I want to say I'm going to be on set around 70 without having counted. I'm probably on that.
I think you're less because I think you see... fewer films than I do, I think, from logging it.
Right.
I don't know why.
How many are you on?
Hang on, sorry. I don't know why I say I think you see fewer films than me. I think because you don't log them, maybe your estimate is lower than. That's what I meant to say. I think your estimate. I think you and I watch the same amount of films, and this year, it says 76, but some of those are rewatches. So actually,
yeah, no rewatches.
Okay, I've got it right here for you, James. My new discoveries this year. I'm at 58.
58, yeah.
So maybe you're in a bit more, maybe you're in the 60s. But I don't think you're
12, count in, you're 12 films ahead of me. See where I'm at.
But that's low for me. That's one of the lowest years I've ever had. Like I said,
my TV watching since doing the show has plummeted. And the number of TV shows as you guys know, I start and then just don't get around to finishing.
I think
that's where I've really lost out. I'm watching a decent amount of films. It's just not.
TV has slowed it so to like a one in, one out policy. Like I only do one at a time.
Yeah. And then I'm parking everything for like the one show I really want to watch, like a Severance or a House of the Dragon or equivalent.
Just shout out to Ghosts, the show on BBC, which is like a gem of mine I love and like is a huge hit, but like not really, I think, with a younger audience, but like just love that show. Final season just came out.
Me and Talia are still slowly making our way through. We're in season 2 of Doctor Who, but like just really enjoying maybe one a week. We're just I told you we started season 1, finished season 1. Great ending to season 1.
Oh, I love the whole first.
I was exclaiming the entire episode, be like, this is the perfect episode of television. It's a 10 out of 10 episode
the
of TV.
The fact that you said to me you were watching season 1 again, and I was able to name each episode.
Yeah, you did.
That
you did. Yeah, and Talia has a really great recall for Doctor Who.
I think that was the best. I remember season 2 being DVD. A little bit not as good. I love season 3.
I remember season 3 is really strong. So I'm looking forward to that. So we've got the end of season 2 is brilliant from what I remember. And season 3 is a load of episodes. It's really good. But season 2 is also great.
How great though is that?
It's really good TV.
But I often think about this. Sorry, huge Doctor Who tangent. Really, but the end of season 4, that series 4, whatever. That whole...
David Tennant's last one.
Yeah, with Donna. What brilliant. Amazing. Moving, sad
I remember
ending.
Where I was when I watched that. And I remember my mum was calling me for dinner and it was live on TV. And I was like, I cannot stop watching this, mum. Like, I'm just going to have to be late. Like, no pausing. It was on Treasure TV. I was like, mum, I'm not leaving. Just eat without me.
Yeah. That is such a brilliant thing. Are you going to watch the specials? Some of the anniversary ones with Tennant?
I should do.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, I think I'll give that a watch.
Yeah. I hope it's not lost to me because I've not watched since Matt Smith.
No, I mean, I'm hoping it's... I think, to be honest with you, it's basically a massive attempt. From my outsider's perspective, I've no knowledge about this, but it's clearly a massive attempt for the BBC to get people back on Doctor Who. Totally. We're literally brought back everyone's favourite Doctor. Yeah. Russell T. Davis
again,
is down.
Which they did for the 50th, right?
And Russell T. Davis is also showrunning it now.
Yeah.
But the Doctor now is David Tennant again. Like,
there are so many moments where I'm like, we're really casually watching this with dinner, where I look at that line that said, where the Doctor says that thing about Rose when maybe everything is lost. And I'm like, oh my God, this is great. That's why you're watching. This is so, so well written. That little moment and that thing is like stringing you along.
Russell T. Davies, absolute genius.
It's a good show. Like, again, that's a really lovely casual watch. We were doing it with Peep Show before.
But that's also the thing I might do with Anna is watch Breaking Bad then Better Call Saul.
I'd love to do
because
that as well.
Because there's no time pressure in the sense that we're not rushing for spoilers or whatever.
It's gone and the conversation has moved on, so you're not going to have to... Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's just on your own
time. You
can
watch it, and if it's a month before you watch the next one, that's fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was TV.
Next one is from Beth, who writes in screenwriter recognition. Hi, James and George. Love the podcast. I've been listening since the early 20s and have been telling everyone I know to listen.
Good on you, Beth.
I wanted to know why you think screenwriters don't get the same level of attention as directors. Yeah. I know directors have such high control over the vision of the work, but why does the screenwriter who makes the story possible never get much recognition? I think about this a lot. I think this about songwriters too. Also, James mentioned a few episodes back that he wanted to watch Solaris. We recently read the novel for a book club, and one of the discussion points we came up was, do you think the point of it was to not understand it at all? We decided this is probably not the point, but didn't quite reach a consensus on what the point actually was. A few members watched the film version to try and make sense of the book, but their main takeaway was that it was not George Clooney's finest work. Oh, possibly a worse project than Batman. So huge congratulations on episode 100. Beth, so you mean the George Clooney 2001 film Solaris? 2002 Solaris. I was talking about what that film is based on, which is Tarkovsky's Solaris, which I think is a very, very different film. Not to shit on that Solaris, but the Tarkovsky Solaris is known to be like one of the greats. I really have been meaning to. I'd love to do a bonus on two Tarkovsky films if I can be bothered, and like tackle them in a way that I think would actually do them justice. But that's a lot of work, and
they sometimes show them at the IMAX.
Yeah. So was it Solaris or was it Stalker? I think Stalker just came on. The BFI are doing so many great things at the BFI IMAX in London right now, and it keeps prompting me to do it. But again, it's just like a timing thing. I would love to do it. I would really, really love to do it. I do Stalker and Solaris and talk about them both if I can.
Beth, on your question about why screenwriters aren't given as much credit as directors, well, I think there's a couple of things there. I mean, obviously, there are loads of unsung heroes of a film crew, and too much weight is often played on the director and the star. And that's not to say that there aren't celebrity screenwriters. You know, people can still think of, you know, Aaron Sorkin's probably the one that people think of as just a purely screenwriter, although he has shifted into directing.
And like Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who's an on-screen writing presence, who gets like brought in a very like pop, like affronted, like mainstream way.
Yeah. I would say that the thing with the director, though, is just that is someone who is involved in the creative direction of that project, no pun intended, but the creative journey of that project from the very, very beginning to the very, very end and beyond. Whereas a screenwriter is really mainly involved in pre-production, possibly production, because I guess rewrites and things like that, but they are not involved in the whole process. It is, a screenplay, someone else said this once, is a quote, it's like, there's an invitation to make a work of art. It's a blueprint. It's not the same as a novel that you're adapting.
Filming it and putting it on camera and deciding how it's to be shot and how that story is told is a different thing. And it's also like, again, we're not chilling on screenwriting.
No, there's a massive skill in screenwriting.
There's a difference, we use the word screenwriting, there's a difference between like writing a story, like films get adapted from novels, which is a different process to writing the screenplay and making it work for a film in 90 minutes or so and have it work. And then like directing, which is going, I see that story, I hear that story, here's what it's about. Here's the lens that I want to tell it through. Yeah. And here's what I want to explore with that idea. It is a different process.
Also, it's a technical skill, screenwriting. And the reason the director is someone who comes in and the best directors will know how to synthesize the best of every single skill that film requires.
Yeah.
Editing, costume, sound, lighting, screenwriting, performance, everything. So unfortunately, it's not that I don't think screenwriters, of course, everyone needs more recognition, but it's like they are part of the crew. This next email is from Olivia, who says, "Hey guys, smiley face. Hope you had a fab Halloween weekend. I for one did. I got to experience a film screening in a cave, which did not disappoint.
Was it The Descent?
There was a variety of horror Halloween movies that was listed for limited screenings for this weekend at the Peak Cavern in Castleton, which is also known as the Devil's Arse." Where do you... you literally...
It's also known as the Devil's Ass. It sounds like an Anchorman line.
You literally cannot get more Halloween-y, if that's even a word. If you tried...
That place was like the Devil's Ass.
How did you spend your Halloween? It was up the Devil's Ass. Up the Devil's Ass.
Imagery.
The atmosphere alone was amazing, and I would be deaf... And I would definitely be back to watch another screening. Me and my friend chose to go to the screening of The Addams Family, which I sadly did not see at the cinema when it was first screened. So to see a family favourite in a cave and share this experience with children and families watching it together for the first time...
Mommy, we're going to watch the film tonight. The Devil's Ass.
This Devil's Arse, please. Please, we're British. Quite magical and brought back nostalgia. Would highly recommend to anyone if they get the opportunity to go down to The Devil's Arse. But defo bring blankets. My question is...
The stones like vaguely resemble just like spreading it.
My question is, where is the quirkiest, weird, wonderful, or even controversial place you have watched a film screening? Warmest regards, live in Manchester. And she has a picture of the Devil's Arse. And look!
Oh my God. I got it on here.
What's the weirdest... The weird, quirkiest, weirdest weird, wonderful, or controversial, quirky. Here's a criteria: quirkiest, weird, wonderful, or even controversial place you've ever watched a film.
I watched a film in a weird place.
I've watched it on
screened.
A bus ride, you know.
Yeah.
I've said this before. I've seen Ted, the Seth MacFarlane yes. film, but in Spanish. Yeah. I understood it, but it was entirely in Spanish.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen films in weird places.
I've obviously done secret cinema quite a few times, which is wonderful.
Yeah, they can't be, I guess, quirky.
I guess that's quirky. That's not weird or controversial.
God, maybe I'm very normative with my screenings. Where do things get screened? I'd love to go beaches to one of those car ones.
I've seen a drive-in. I did that during COVID.
I think that'd be really nice.
That was the only time I've seen Moulin Rouge.
Oh, nice. That's a great one speaker. For it. Yeah.
Quirkiest or
they do the screen. I've not been to one, but there's the screen on the South Bank where they sometimes screen sports, but they do films there.
I think controversial is when you tell me how Talia watched Glass Onion.
Yeah. On a phone at whatever time in the morning in a layover in Addis Ababa. And then she was like, yeah. I said, oh, it's great. You should watch it. And then she's watching it on her phone, going through passport. Stop, look terrible. At this, security. And then she finishes it. Like, what do you think? She goes, yeah, I guess it was all right. And I'm like, well.
Yeah, how? No.
You just. This last one is from Cameron, who writes in with a question. Are fans too involved in movie franchises? Hello, George and James. Firstly, love the show. I came to your pub quiz for the 100th episode, had a great time. I was the as advertised mega fan who arrived late, but I have to apologize. I rushed from work to get there and was quite frazzled when I arrived, so I never really got the chance to properly say hi. So I thought I'd send an email saying that I think the podcast is great. It was very funny and insightful, but always unassuming, and the impressions are hilarious. Cameron, I swear we did say hi to you very briefly.
I think he was saying more that he felt like he'd just arrived, so he felt he wasn't able to introduce himself properly. But Cameron, I will say your whole table was great fun. Yeah. You were great. Great to meet you. Your table went for the team name of George's Cup of Tea to try and get that extra 5 points.
Which didn't work.
Didn't work, but I cheered you when that name was read out because that's a great name and I saw it and thank you. So we see you. We saw you.
Cameron, thank you so much for coming and for listening. My question is, what are your thoughts on movie franchises with huge fan bases that in many ways try to dictate what the content and characters of a film should be? I'm talking about franchises like Marvel or Star Wars, where fan theories and expectations are plentiful. My example is always The Last Jedi, which faced criticism as fans didn't get what they were expecting after months of speculation, and in particular for the slight reimagining of Luke Skywalker. Personally, I liked the film and didn't find the direction Ryan Johnson went with impossible to believe, but I know many fans have predetermined expectations for these films and characters. However, in my opinion, I think the story is the most important element to any film, and the characters should service that. But what are your thoughts? Do writers, directors have a responsibility to the upkeep of fan expectation, or is their duty more to the story and the message of the film they're trying to convey? Sorry for the hefty email. Big love, Cameron.
Cameron, two things on that. First of all, I do believe that as a director, you have a license. Especially if you're adapting something. Yeah. I don't care if you're adapting well-loved comics or whatever, really. It needs to work as a film.
Totally.
It needs to work as a film first and foremost. If you're able to kind of give stuff for the fans, great. But like one thing that's great about the Dungeons & Dragons movie that came out this year is it's
no
so
experience
fun because
necessary.
No experience necessary. And it doesn't hold you as a non-player at a distance. It's actually able to bring you in. On The Last Jedi,
never isolated anyone, that's true.
On The Last Jedi, the thing is, it's like, I think it got quickly dragged into a conversation about the problem with this film is that it doesn't honor the fans or stuff. And I'm like, that actually misses the point. The problem with The Last Jedi is not about honoring the fans. It's just architecturally, it does not build and function well with the film that that comes before it, which is The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
If it was, I've said this before, if it was the first film in this trilogy, absolutely fine.
But also,
as a second film, it makes no sense.
Also, it makes no sense because the Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, and frankly the whole series, invites you as an audience to wonder questions to answers they ask in the first place.
Yeah.
It's like, who is Snoke? Yeah. Who is Rey? Which turns out to be mostly irrelevant or very disappointing. Yes. It's like, well, of course, you made it seem like that was very important. You did these long cryptic Dagobah cave sequences from Empire and like alluded to things and clones. It's like...
Exactly. So that film,
you invited me to get really into the conversation.
Force Awakens goes, who's this? Who's that? And then
Force Awakens like, who is the girl? Yeah. Screen wipes the next scene. So now I'm going, who's the girl? Who's the girl?
The Last Jedi.
But
then The Last Jedi, that's why it's frustrating because the film basically goes like, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Why are you even asking that question?
That's the irrelevant. Lightsaber that was like sacred. Yeah. As an entity, just throw it over. Yeah. Honestly... Loads of stuff that takes fans for granted. I think when you say movie franchises with huge fan bases that in many ways try to dictate what the content and character film should be. I don't know if they're, it's hard to say that if people are like literally dictating what it should be, but I think they're just, they have expectations on what it should be because I think they know it really, really well. Mm. And that's, I think, the game you get into when you bring back IP from decades to gone that have been like adored for that long a time. People are going to be very protective over what you, what you do to it. I do think,
and I think the internet does not help as a place for people to kind of be overprotective.
No, but they all, it's like, it's just, they do too much of it. And you just invite more problems the more you try and do, and the more you touch a thing, the more fingerprints it has on it. Mm.
Anyway, thank you very much for your emails this week. It was really, as ever, it's always a joy reading them out.
They're the best.
We love to hear from you guys. Like the pub quiz, it just it's lovely to remind you guys that you're out there listening to
you're
us.
Out there.
It's fantastic. James, shall we end this episode, as we always do?
With a game.
Yes.
George, it's episode 101. And as always, it's not going to change. We're not changing the structure yet. Pulp Kitchen ends with a game.
Yes.
Today, we're bringing back, I don't want to say a favourite, because I think you have been wearied by this game, but I believe you're more than capable.
Yes, you've
I've always believed you're more than capable.
Yeah.
This game is Co-Star Countdown. This is a game where I'm going to choose the body of an actor's work. I will reveal the actor shortly. And then I'm going to read their co-stars, and every time I read a co-star, you have to tell me what film they were in together. George, do you understand the rules?
I do.
I hope everyone understands the rules at home. Please feel free to play along. George, today's actor whose filmography we will go through is none other than Emily Blunt.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
Now, before you just get all the films swimming in your head, we're going to start. So, George, you have to name me the Emily Blunt film based on her co-star.
Okay.
Ready? 3, 2, 1. John Krasinski.
A Quiet Place.
Yes. Tom Cruise.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Yes. Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Mary Poppins Returns.
Yes. Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Jungle Cruise.
Yes. Cillian Murphy.
A Quiet Place Part 2.
Sure. Oppenheimer,
yeah.
Benicio Del Toro.
Sicario.
Yes. Chris Hemsworth.
Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yes. Matt Damon.
The Adjustment Bureau.
Yes. John Name. Rupert Friend. The Young Victoria. Luke Evans.
Beauty in the... No.
No.
She's not in that.
No. What on the what? The Girl on the Train. Last one. Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep and Emily Blunt. Devil Wears Prada.
God, yeah, that was the easy one at the end.
That's good.
It's a good one, isn't it? It's quite good.
I don't know when we last played that. It's been a long
time. A while ago.
And I'm sure I probably was really moody and like, nah, I don't like it. Yeah. But I feel like I understand the game better. It feels like I've never played it before.
I know, it's good. It's a good game.
Do you have another one?
No. I can find another one.
The Adjustment Bureau is one of those movies that's just been completely forgotten.
Loads
of movies.
It's almost like Matt Damon and Emily Blunt have been in a movie together. Like, when? Apart from Oppenheimer.
Yeah. But in lots of 2011 movies, I associate with being really forgetful, like forgotten. I think Salmon Fishing in the Yemen.
Was that nominated?
No, it was Ewan McGregor and Kristen Scott Thomas, and they were salmon fishing in the Yemen.
That's so funny. It's a funny title, that's why.
And
of the skit of like the films that got gone, why does nobody remember Salmon Fishing in the Yemen?
I know. It sounds like a film you'd forget.
You've got like Duck Hunting in the Oasis.
Yeah. Anyway, and the other one is Water for Elephants. Remember that?
I remember that film. Yeah,
similar.
But yeah, it doesn't come up. Like when you think Robert Pattinson, it doesn't come up. When you think Christoph Waltz, it doesn't come up. Who's in that?
Reese Witherspoon.
God, yeah. Like what? No one. Yeah, that counts.
I would have also said We Bought a Zoo, but my girlfriend loves that film.
Really?
And I've never seen it. And I look at it. And I go, really?
That was when Matt Damon went more experimental than he currently is.
Experimental. We Bought a Zoo was like big, broad family comedy.
Yeah, but like for Matt Damon, it's like he did lots of different things.
He did the sci-fi movie, he did the thing.
Yeah, he was just having fun. Yeah, Contagion, but like he was a small role in
it. Yes, that's Matt Damon. That's 2012, but yeah, I'll accept it.
There's a period. I'm taking
a period. Actually, I think that is 2011, Contagion. I will accept that.
I think it's 2011,
Yeah. Sorry, why am I such a stickler for dates?
I know, it's your one of your things. We just let you go.
I've got one for you, James.
Okay.
I'm going to give you... do you not want that?
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
Okay. I'm going to give you a name 7 in 30.
Okay.
Okay. James.
You need a timer.
I do.
Otherwise, you'd get all of them. Wow, didn't he do well?
He got 400.
Let's go for 30 seconds, which is the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. James, in 30 seconds, name 7 non-Harry Potter Daniel Radcliffe films. Go.
Okay, you've got Horns.
Yep.
You've got Guns Akimbo.
Right.
You've got Swiss Army Man. You've got The Woman in Black. You've got the Lost City with Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum. You've got What If. And one more.
10 seconds.
The magic one. Did you miss me? What's it called?
No!
I can't remember. Did you see me? Now you see me.
Yeah,
now
well
you
see done. Me. Bang on time. Oh, well done.
God.
Yeah, now you see. No. I actually
now you see me.
No, he's in Now You See Me Too.
Yeah.
But I will accept that. Yeah. Well done. Because, yes, fuck. You get the initial ones out of the way.
Yes.
But yeah. He's also done some random
and all
ones.
All really different.
Did you say Horns? You started with Horns.
I did start with Horns, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Horns.
No, me neither.
He also was in a film called Imperium, which is about a guy who... like
far right.
Penetrates a far right group and he like shaves his hair and has to get a tattoo. It's very intense. I did watch that, actually. It's quite interesting. But Daniel Radcliffe, I quite like his choices that he's done. He's really sort of shopped around and kept himself interested.
I would also have accepted Trainwreck. He's in the. Do you remember he's in Trainwreck with all the dogs in the trailer?
Yes, yeah,
fake trailer with Marissa Tomei.
Yeah, I do remember. He plays himself in that.
No, he plays Daniel Radcliffe in a movie.
Fine, okay.
You know, starring Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah, okay. Fine.
Anyway, that guys was a little game.
Are we not going to do this?
Oh, no, we can. Sorry.
Yeah, you sure? Okay, George. I've got another game for you. This is a cast list countdown.
Okay.
For anyone who doesn't know.
Right.
I'm going to read out the cast of a film.
I like this. We've kind of batted it back and forth.
They're doing lots of things. You have to tell me what film I'm talking about based on the cast.
Yes.
So I'll read out members of the cast. You'll just tell me what film it is before I get to the last cast member. George, are you ready?
I'm ready.
This is cast list countdown. You have to guess the film based on its cast. Ready? 3, 2, 1. John Bernthal. Brian Tyree Henry. Daniel Kaluuya.
Okay.
Michelle Rodriguez.
Michelle Rodriguez?
Colin Farrell. Liam Neeson. Elizabeth Debicki. Last one.
Widows.
Yes.
Wow.
Widows. Last one, Viola Davis.
Yes. The Steve McQueen one. Film.
Which is...
Bit of a forgotten film.
Complete is my point why I raised it. Completely forgotten with a really top cast.
You know what? That film got good reviews when it came
2014.
Out. 2018.
Sorry.
Did you go and see it?
No.
I've not seen it
and I've just realized I love Steve McQueen and I it's got good
you
reviews.
You missed out Robert Duvall as well, who's in there.
Oh, he's not on the Googles. That's a shame.
Well, did you go on IMDb? What are you trusting Google for?
No, Google's useless. I shouldn't
I didn't realize this was your first episode.
Yeah. First time playing the game.
I'm pretty sure there's more. Cynthia Erivo's
in
that
there's others,
well.
But I just for efficiency.
Oh, I see. Fair enough. Yeah. Well, the thing is with Widows is that.
Is it good?
This is what I'm going to try and tell you, James. This is what I'm trying to
podcasting.
Tell you. It's got a hell of a cast and it's got a hell of a good, like, good premise. And I just, it's not that gripping. I don't know if, like, Steve McQueen makes a good thriller. You know, like,
right.
Shane's a really interesting character study. 12 Years a Slave is, like, harrowing and beautiful and terrifying. And then Widows, I don't know. It felt very cold. It felt like the whole film felt better. Like it was above getting its hands dirty as a thriller. When I'm like, you've got really good bones there. And I just... there's a reason it's been forgotten.
That's totally, yeah.
It speaks for itself. No one's walking around going... What a great film that was. Oh, Widows. Yeah, it's like, well, no.
I chose it because it fits into that, like, yeah, that film category for Cast List Countdown. And that's why it was there with a great cast, obviously.
That's really the best kind of film we use for this.
Yeah, yeah. Those are like the sweet spot.
There's a really good line in it, though, where Robert Duvall says, hey, sorry, strong language coming in. But he goes, hey, fuck you and the horse you rode in on.
Nice. That's funny. It wasn't on a horse, I assume.
No, I guess it's your high horse.
Yeah, oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Fuck you and the horse you rode in
on. I haven't seen the film, so it could have been horses everywhere.
And that's episode 101. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Pop Kitchen.
That's the reference.
Yes, that's our Dalmatian episode. James, do you want to do a bit?
Thank you so much for listening.
We really appreciate you spending your time with us. Don't forget.
Say it like you mean it.
Posting new episodes of the show. Yeah, thanks for listening. It's cool. Now, I've done 100, so it's like, it's whatever. Don't forget we post new episodes.
He was joking, by the way.
Yeah. I love the podcast, I guess. Every single Wednesday.
And whether you're listening to this on a bus in Thailand flying over the Australian barren outback.
Maybe you're just salmon fishing in the Yemen.
Please remember to like and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok. And we really do depend on it. And it's, we do.
We need to know totally.
Like,
yeah.
We absolutely do. And we really appreciate it. Like, subscribe, send in your emails, comment on the videos, share them, put them on your story. We really appreciate it. And as ever, thanks always for your listenership.
I know something like 65 to 70% of you who are watching / listening right now aren't subscribed.
Why?
What's up?
Let's change that, guys.
Come on.
Do something good today.
Press it now. Yeah. Do us a huge favor. It means that we can do cooler things and see more films. Yeah.
More than that. That's why we do this.
Yeah.
Have a great week, guys. We will be back next week.
102.
See
Bye.
You then.